This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is the guidepost for the Hall of Pure Bliss by Master Hongzhi, a 12th century master. By seeking appearances and sounds, one cannot truly find the way. The deep source of realization comes with constancy, bliss, self, and purity. Its purity is constant. Its bliss is myself. The two are mutually dependent, like firewood and fire. The self's bliss is not exhausted. Constant purity has no end. Deep existence is beyond forms. Wisdom illuminates the inside of the circle. Inside the circle, the self vanishes, neither existent nor non-existent. Intimately conveying spiritual energy, it subtly turns the mysterious pivot. When the mysterious pivot finds opportunity to turn, the original light auspiciously appears. When the mind's conditioning is not yet sprouted, how can words and images be distinguished? Who is it that can distinguish them? Clearly understand and know by yourself. Whole and inclusive with inherent insight, it's not concerned with discriminative thought. When discriminating thought is not involved, it's like white reed flowers shining in the snow. This is just the first part of this extended poem by Master Hongzhi, who is a really important master in 12th century China. He is most known for having compiled the koans of the Book of Serenity and having written the poems accompanying each of those koans, and for the collection of his teachings that was titled Cultivating the Empty Field. His father was a Zen practitioner, and he left home. He was said to have been quite bright and of a literary bent. It said he knew some thousands of characters by the time he was, I don't know, something crazy like six. A little bit like Dogen. And he entered a monastery when he was 11 and was ordained at 14, which was not unheard of at that time, Buddhism being what it was at that period of time. And then at 23, he went traveling and studied with different masters. And he studied primarily with a master named Dangxia Zichun, whom he succeeded. And Dangxia's teacher, Hongzhi's Dharma grandfather, was really instrumental in helping to revitalize the Soto Zen, the Caodong school in China, which is our lineage. And, you know, these different lineages and schools went through such phases in their periods of time. Some just died out altogether. Many, in fact, died out altogether in the sense that the lineage just didn't continue. There would be no heir. And schools both in the Soto tradition and in the Linchi tradition went through periods where it became very sort of inert, just not very vital, kind of heavily institutionalized, formulaic, and then a very strong teacher would come along and breathe life back into it. Hakuin was a very important master in Japan who did that for the Linchi school. And so that was part of Hongzhi's lineage. And Hongzhi became abbot of Tiantong Monastery. And sometimes when you're are reading the literature, you'll see him referred to, for instance, in the Book of Serenity, as Tiantong. And that was kind of his nickname, taking on the name of the monastery. And that same monastery Dogen studied at with Chuching when he went to China. So this connection is close. When he first came to Tiantong Monastery, it was kind of dilapidated, very small, and he built it up quite significantly to the point where it was said to accommodate 1,200 monastics in the meditation hall at the same time. So just think about that. When I traveled to Japan, you know, there are training monasteries with these vast, vast halls. And it's said that at one point, because he was very popular, that he had attracted 1,500. The head of the temple came to Hongzhi and said, you know, what are we going to do? We've got to send some of these people away. And he said something like, everyone, each of them has their own mouth to feed. Let them stay. And so somehow they squeezed blood from a stone and made it all work. He stayed there at Tiantong Monastery for almost 30 years without leaving. And in the last year of his life, he went down the mountain and he visited local officials and patrons, people who had been very supportive of the monastery over those many years and helped it to exist. And he visited them and expressed his gratitude to them. And then he returned on November 10th, it said, and bathed and put on fresh robes and gave a farewell talk to his Sangha. And then he wrote a letter to Dawei, who was another prominent teacher in the Rinzai School, and I'll say a little bit more about their relationship tomorrow, asking him, Dawei, to take care of the monastery when he died, which is very interesting because Dawei was in an entirely different, not only different lineage, but different school. And then he wrote his death poem, Illusory Dreams, Phantom Flowers, 67 years, a white bird vanishes in the mist, autumn waters merge with the sky. And then he passed away while sitting in Zazen. That's how I'd like to go. And so he was, as many of you are familiar with his, at least somewhat with his poetry, he was one of the great poets in the Zen tradition, really, and in Buddhism. His poetry is really exquisite. And of course, we're reading translations, so one can only, a non-Chinese speaking person can only guess at what his poetry might be like in his native language. And so here he has this extended poem, Guidepost for the Hall of Pure Bliss. And so I want to speak, just offer commentary on this, the first part of it today, and then the latter part on Saturday. So it begins by saying, by seeking appearances and sounds, one cannot truly find the way. And this is spoken of over and over again in the teachings. The caution or the teaching about being deceived by appearances. And so, you know, whenever we encounter something over and over again, it means we really should stop and study it. What is meant here? What is being referred to? What does appearances mean? So, obviously, it is referring to how things appear. So when we open our eyes and we see something, we see its appearance. When we listen and we hear something, we hear its sound. And so it's how things come to us. And our senses are so dominant within our being, within our existence. It's how we know everything. It's how we know we're alive. It's how we know each other is alive. It's how we know what everything about everything. that is within the field of our senses. And so in that way, they are vast and profound and have tremendous influence. And at the same time, they're limited because they work within a particular sphere, the sphere of sensory consciousness and sensory objects. That which can be seen, that which can be touched, that which can be described and measured. That's their domain. And so in these appearances, we find delight and uplift and satisfaction and pleasure and inspiration and soothing, affirmation. We also experience many other things: fright, fear, intimidation, overwhelm, disappointment, discouragement, agitation. And because they're so dominant, we can take them as conveying the whole, as leaving nothing out. Even though all along the way we're getting a sense that the messages we're getting through our senses is not and cannot be complete. Our experiences don't always jive with other people's experiences. We can't smell like a dog. We can't make sounds like a whale. We can't listen like an elephant. And so they're limited. So different animals experience the world in different ways. But they seem to be all we know, and so we take what they convey, those appearances and sounds, as the world. And if we don't examine that very much, we'll do that our entire lives. But going that way, we cannot find peace because we cannot find true understanding. Because they do not convey the whole. They cannot. Not because they are insufficient, but because they are instruments that work within particular realms. That's their design. Mind, however, is not so limited. And so we do find moments of peace and fulfillment and satisfaction and understanding. And those moments move. They come and go. And they come and go rather quickly. And so we come to see that we can't rely on those for any kind of lasting anything. That what we perceive through the senses, those by seeking appearances and sounds, we cannot truly experience what we long to experience, which is something that we can actually take refuge in. And the more we experience that, the sort of fickle quality of our senses, the transitory nature of everything that we experience through practice, the more we realize we cannot take refuge there. We cannot rely upon. The Buddha spoke of this in the First Noble Truth, life is dukkha. All things are impermanent, nothing lasts, and therefore every single blessed attempt to find something lasting within impermanence will by its very nature fail. And that when those moments pass, we will have some experience of inner sadness or dis-ease or dissatisfaction. And so beginning to recognize that on some level, usually before we even really understand what we're experiencing, encountering the Dharma helps us to understand what we're experiencing, right? I mean, how many of us had that experience that as we were studying the Dharma and as we continue to study the Dharma, we find it expressing something that we realize in that moment we know and we have known, but didn't know that we knew. or didn't know how to recognize what it was we were experiencing. And so then we raise bodhicitta, the mind that seeks the way, not that way, not through appearances and sounds. Bodhicitta is the pursuit of something that we want, which is not no longer content with just the ephemeral, and that is weary of the endless highs and lows, and trying to extend the highs as long as possible and avoid the lows as much as possible, and never quite succeeding. And so having that ongoing internal spinning. In the Connected Discourses, the Buddha, somebody came, a highly evolved being, came to the Buddha and said, "Life is swept along, short is the lifespan. No shelters exist for one who has reached old age. The stages of life successively desert us. Seeing clearly this danger in our mortality, we should do deeds of merit that bring happiness. We should live a good life, do wholesome deeds that bring us merit, that creates good karma, that creates the possibility of liberation." And the Buddha responded, "Life is swept along, short is the lifespan. No shelters exist for one who has reached old age. The stages of life successively desert us. Seeing clearly this danger in life, a seeker of peace should drop the world's bait." And so we stop and turn in. We stop expecting, almost stop expecting, for the many things of the world, those appearances and sounds, to save us, to make us happy, to deliver us, to not make us angry. He goes on, "The deep source of realization comes with constancy, bliss, self, and purity." So realization, to make real, the Buddha spoke of, he didn't use the word liberation, he spoke of doing what must be done. He spoke of realization as doing, this person in realizing him or herself has done what should be done. Very compelling. This is what we should do in our lives. To make real, to make real to ourselves the discovery of the real. To know beyond speculation, beyond our imagination, beyond our senses, what is the real. Direct pointing and the realization of Buddhahood, of enlightenment. And so to realize the deep source of this realization comes with constancy. And so he lists these practices, these qualities. And the Buddha was abundant, generous with talking about all of these different practices, qualities that we need to be bringing forth within ourselves that we need for the road. That we will find ourselves needing to draw upon this quality, this virtue. Fortunately, we have them. They exist within us. All of them. Some of them more brought out than others. And so constancy, moment to moment, one awareness, one dharma, one practice, one realization, one subtle communication. Sesshin is a practice of constancy. And constancy doesn't mean some kind of permanent state. It means constancy within impermanence, in which everything is impermanent. constancy within impermanence. Constancy of what? Of mind, of awareness, of intention, of aspiration, of faith, of perseverance, of energy, of all of those qualities that we need, that are being called for us to bring forth in order to continue the path, to realize this path. And constancy is sort of the antidote to our, you know, to our sort of flickering state of being, on, off, on, off, on, off, on, off, on, off, on, off. Jumping, 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 jumping. And so we, you know, we all know that flickering state. And then as we begin practicing, we begin having moments of constancy, a brief moment of constancy. And then that moment and successive moments, usually broken up with diversions, distractions, flickering. But then those moments begin to extend, expand, elongate, become more stable, become more constant. As we develop our mindfulness, as we develop our faith, as we develop our motivation. And it's not just mindfulness. That's important to understand. It's all of those various qualities. It's stability. You know, the monastic vow of stability is related to this virtue of constancy. It's the vow to have a stable life, which means to be working towards constancy and stability emotionally, mentally, intellectually, physically, meditatively, study-wise, relationally. All within an ongoing state of impermanence. And that's really important to understand. It's not trying to fix anything. But within that non-fixedness, there is constancy. Bliss, we spoke about this during when we studied the seven factors of enlightenment. Bliss is, and these are both, some of these are qualities that we practice, like constancy, but then they also come forth from practicing. So the practice of constancy breeds constancy. Bliss is not so something you practice deliberately, right? Otherwise it becomes contrived, but rather is something that naturally arises out of practice. Ascend. The Buddha spoke often in terms of rapture. Right? And during that retreat, we talked about how to understand that so it doesn't sound like some sort of ecstatic, you know, drug trip, hallucinatory, you know. But it is a arising of joy, of serenity, of a sense of elation, lightness of being. And at the same time, it has groundedness, right? It has stability. You can think of it as the body of the Buddha, the Sambhogakaya, the body of bliss, the reward body. And in a very real way, it's the mind's affirmation, or the body-mind's affirmation, that we're on a true path. You know, we all have the experience, particularly early on, where we're practicing, it seems like things are really hard, sometimes it seems like things are getting worse. And we take those as signs, or we wonder, are these signs that this isn't working, this isn't good, I'm not doing it right? Rarely is that true. Usually what's happening is we're just encountering ourself without any distraction. And as time goes on, those bliss experiences, which is not being blissed out, but it's these naturally sort of uplifting experiences, which are affirming that we are on a path that is true. In the same way that the other side, when we're not practicing or we're actively practicing, the other aspects of the other side of those good qualities, the negative side of those good qualities, and we experience a lot of negative, we have a lot of negative experiences within our mind and body, those are affirmations. Those are affirmations of what we're doing. The deep source of realization comes with constancy, bliss, self, and purity. Self here is the true self, letting go of the grasping at the idea of self. Letting go of grasping at identities. Though they may persist, that the grasping drops away. At the need to cherish oneself, which is different than acceptance, having compassion for, loving kindness towards the self. It's abiding and non-abiding. It's the freedom that arises from within, no longer having to support, promote, defend, sustain, grow, lose the self. And purity. Purity here is really freedom from all notions of pure and impure. You know, and that's why we really do need to study what the Buddha, what the Dharma is teaching, because all of these words have meaning in language, and we come loaded with understanding about what these words mean. So when you hear Hongzhu say purity, that means something to every one of us, just naturally. And because that's the word that's been chosen to translate the original, it will, some of what we'll assume it means will probably be true, but other things we'll assume it mean are not true. And so it has nothing to do with being perfect or without flaw. Purity is our inherent perfection, our inherent completeness, which has nothing to do with perfectionism. It's the nature of everything. It's nothing special. And it's liberating. You can't create it, you can't destroy it. It's not a result of our actions, good or bad. And yet the actions we take will either bring forth, in a sense, bring us closer to that experience, that realization of purity, or will take us further away. In fact, when we act not well, the affirmation of those actions seems to strengthen and solidify that sense that we are impure. Its purity is constant. The purity that arises out of realization is constant. It's unbroken. That's its nature. And it's unbroken within impermanence. It's unbroken because it doesn't come or go, because you haven't done it. And you can't ruin it. Its purity is constant. Its bliss is myself. It doesn't come from the outside. Finally, you're home. I spoke last week about Master Dongshan, who came to his teacher Yunyan and said, I have some habits that are not yet exhausted. And Yunyan said, what have you been doing? Dongshan said, I haven't concerned myself with the Four Noble Truths. I do not concern myself with the Four Noble Truths. And Yunyan said, are you joyful yet? And Dongshan said, to say that I'm not joyful would be untrue. It's as though I've grasped a bright pearl within a pile of shit. Bliss is myself. And the bliss, the joy that Dongshan speaks of is not in conflict with his having habits he has not yet exhausted. They're there, but they no longer disturb. no longer dependent on external situation, people. Now we can be in situations, in relationship with people. These two are mutually dependent, like firewood and fire, arising together. The self's bliss is not exhausted. Constant purity has no end. Deep existence is beyond forms. Wisdom illuminates the inside of the circle. Inside the circle, the self vanishes. It's neither existent nor non-existent. He's inviting us inside the circle. He's saying, from the beginning, you are inside the circle. This is deep existence. Zazen is entering into the circle. Dogen spoke of the inner chamber. And we have so many examples, so many astoundingly trivial, superficial examples of living on the surface of things. We also have tragic, terrible, horrific examples of the results of living on the surface of things, of not having deep existence, of not living in this circle. Free of seeking things from the outside, going beyond forms, deep existence is beyond forms. And now, as faith mind says, we can move among and in among them and intermingle without distinction. We're no longer seduced or deceived by appearances and forms. And so sometimes people, particularly in the beginning of practice, worry about this, and they think, oh, that means I'm no longer going to enjoy fill in the blanks. Sex, shopping, a good meal, being with my friends, sleeping, a good shit. What it really means is now we can enjoy all that is enjoyable and enjoy it for what it is enjoyable and no longer be disappointed for all that it's not, for all the ways that that simple pleasure betrays us. We see red, we see blue, we see yellow, we see feel coarse and fine, we hear sweet and discordant. Each arises as it is, free of the tyranny of meaning, of our projections, of our expectations. Oh my God, the crushing weight of our expectations. At the same time that we don't deny the meaning that something that we might give or that is given to something. Why? Because it might have value. It might serve. That meaning of that might serve. You wake up from a dream. You reflect on what it means. You come to some conclusions, but it doesn't move you. You wake up, you have a dream. You reflect on its meaning. It's significant. It's a pivot dream. It serves you. This circle, right? This symbol, this image, this shape that is imprinted within each of us. Maybe it's the sun and moon that is understood in every place, in every culture. The enso, the mudra, the eye. The circle is the symbol of the Dharmakaya, the body of the Buddha, the body of emptiness. It's the eighth Oxherding picture. Intimately conveying spiritual energy, it subtly turns the mysterious pivot. When the mysterious pivot finds opportunity to turn, the original light auspiciously appears. Hongzhi's poetry is intended to inspire us. The teachings, so many of the teachings, are intended to inspire us because that's very powerful. When we are inspired, it's very powerful. And isn't that an interesting thing, that we can hear words and something within us moves? And so why not use that? And at the same time, within his poetry, he's conveying truths. He's speaking about truths like spiritual energy, like the mysterious pivot. Intimately conveying. You know, intimacy, it's like Brené Brown says, you know, vulnerability is the thing that we so appreciate in others. It so endears us to others, but we don't want it ourselves. Intimacy is like that, right? Because it is a vulnerable. Being intimate is being vulnerable. It's what we seek and it's what we fear. To see, but also to be seen. To feel, but also to be felt. To hear and to be heard, to know and to be known. That's why Sangha is so important. You know, sometimes when a student or a teacher sort of is a circuit practitioner or a circuit teacher, in other words, they never stay anywhere very long. There can be different reasons for that. But one thing that happens is intimacy becomes difficult. The intimacy that grows out of living and practicing together. I remember years ago when Joan Chittister was here, a Catholic nun who has written many books. We studied her book on the rule of St. Benedict. And she was here, very dynamic, powerful nun, woman, writer. And people were, you know, appreciating her and, you know, expressing a lot of gratitude for her. And she was like, thank you, that's fine. But she said, you know, that's all well and good. But what's really important to me, she said, doing this is easy. What's really important to me is when I go back home to my convent, are they happy to see me? That's what I want to know. She says, if they're happy to see me, then I may be doing something well. And this energy, we spoke about that last weekend, this great virya, this joyful effort, this energy, ki, aliveness, spirit, inspiration, motivation, perseverance, faith, everything we do, everything has ki, everything, animate or inanimate. Practice demands it, thrives on it. And it's not just energy that gets you out of bed. It's the vitality that is yes as you get out of bed. That is, even when it's difficult, not wanting to be somewhere else. When we let go, in releasing, in renunciation, in dropping the world's bait, energy, that energy is released, spiritual energy. And you feel it. It's not a philosophical thing. You feel it. You are the recipient of that energy. And that's why, again, another affirmation in the beginning of practice, why we can often struggle with our energy. Right? So one of the reasons why I asked the Jikido not to make tons of coffee right before we come into the Zendo. Right? The time for that has passed. The time now is to, having had a cup of tea or coffee, is now to come to the Zendo and now rely on your own resources, on our own resources, to bring forth that energy. And you know where you learn it most deeply is when you need it most deeply. Because that's the way we are. When you really need that thing, that quality, that virtue, that's when we dig deep. Because you have to. You can't screw around. You have to find it. And you do. And in that moment, and it doesn't happen, you know, in the first moment when you apply yourself, but when that happens, that is a pivot point. Something has changed forever in that moment. It doesn't mean that you will always be able to call upon, but something inside of you has changed. You have discovered something that you both have conscious access to and also has deep roots that we don't yet understand. And that's why the for lack of a better word, the discipline, the intensity, the rigorousness of practice, that when we meet all of those many, many limits, I can't, in all of the different ways that sentiment appears. I'm at the limit, no more, can't be, impossible. That we meet that limit and are held, right? Because otherwise we might squirm, wiggle, back off, retreat, run like hell, give up, condemn, argue. And, you know, we do all of those things too. But being held, but you're doing them on your seat, right? And ultimately, hopefully, you wear that out, right? Because the thing that we're being held to isn't going away. In fact, it's probably getting bigger. And in that moment, we find a way in. That is the pivot point. And when you experience that again and again and again and again in all different scenes and situations and circumstances and barriers, we begin to understand something at a different level. You are not what you seem. Abiding in non-abiding. When the mind's conditioning is not yet sprouted, how can words and images be distinguished? Before the mind moves, or within a clear mind, a radiant mind, the mind moves and nothing is disturbed. Appearances form without distinction. Conditioning means, when the mind's conditioning has not yet sprouted, how can words and images be distinguished? So that means that the sprouting of our minds is dependent. They do not arise on their own. We should really reflect on what that means. That each and everything that appears does not appear on its own, does not arise on it under its own power. What are the conditions under which it arises? What if those conditions change? Whole and inclusive with inherent insight, the insight that is already present within us. It is not concerned with discriminative thought. no longer worried, no longer upset, no longer separate. One thing, all things, move among them now and intermingle without distinguish. Categories, compartments, divisions, boundaries are all seen as constructions. If they're useful, use them. If they're not, don't. To live in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. Hongzhir described his life as one continuous mistake. Think about that. Here's a deeply realized being. Spent his whole blessed life within the Dharma. What could he mean by that? One continuous mistake. To be without anxiety about non-perfection. While sitting, while standing, while walking, while lying down. To practice this faith. To live this realization. Like white reed flowers shining in the snow. All things have one essence. And look at those beautiful flowers against the snow. Our purity is no anxiety about non-perfection. It is constant. Practice is to awaken us to this. The bliss, the joy, the serenity is not in you, as Hongzhir says. It is you. And so, as we continue in the Sesshin, let's remember the Buddha's words, a seeker of peace should drop the world's bait, drop the mind's bait, enter into the circle.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.